The BBC presents My Music, a radio panel game devised by Edward J. Mason and Tony Schreier. And here's Steve Race to introduce the teams.
Thank you very much. And once again, here on the stage of the Commonwealth Institute in London, it's my pleasure to introduce to you those four giants of musical knowledge. Ian Wallace and Dennis Norden, competing against John Amis and Frank Muir. The first round this week is all about music and food. Even a songwriter must eat, as a well-known music publisher once remarked. And these songs are all to do with eating in one way or another. Ian Wallace, here's a fellow national of yours.
A beautiful Sunday. I wish it would never come Monday, cause I lie between the sheets, my bed adorning. Oh, it's very nice. Yes, it's very, very nice.
What's very, very nice, Ian?
Your breakfast in your bed on Sunday morning.
Yes.
I don't know whether that's the right tune,
yes,
but I think that's the sentiment.
To get your breakfast in your bed on Sunday morning.
Doesn't it mark the sheets?
All that marmalade, isn't it?
Yes.
And playing those sort of records certainly mark them too, the way that they all started and finished.
Yes. I'll tell you something else they used to start I'll tell you something else Sir Harry Lauder's record started with. The most mirthless laugh I've ever heard. Listen to this. Most sinister laugh ever. I've no doubt he was a perfectly marvellous performer. That laugh chills the blood, doesn't it? Anyway, you've got to start it off, Ian, with the mark. And, again, still something to do with food. Dennis, for you, something sweet.
I will return. I'll return. I'll come back for the honey and you.
Dennis, who'll come back?
That was Anthony Benedict. What was his name? Anthony Dominic Benedetto. And changed his name to Tony Bennett.
Yes, that's right. Mm. In the song...
The Taste of Honey.
Yes. Do you remember whose play started all that Taste of Honey stuff?
Yes, it was a lady... Actually, there were quite a lot of novels and plays been written about Salford. This was a girl who came from Salford, called Sheila Delaney.
That's right, yes. But your mark is for saying Tony Bennett, of course. John, think American, think Hollywood, in fact, and see if you can identify this really very good singer.
Put on the skillet, put on the lead. Mammy's gonna bake a little shortening bread. That ain't all she's gonna do. Mammy's gonna make a little coffee too.
Good voice. Who was it?
Is it one of the guys who was in one of the Marx Brothers films?
No. No, you're thinking of sort of Tony Martin, aren't
yes.
you? No, a rather deeper voice than that.
Well, then I'm...
Well, he was born in Rhode Island in 1901.
A good. Chicken.
No, not a Rhode Island red, a Rhode Island blonde, actually. It was Nelson Eddy, of Jeanette MacDonald and fame. And I didn't want to sound patronising anyway, but it's quite a pleasant surprise to hear that Nelson Eddy, on a record, without seeing him in a film, had such a really very good voice as that. A fine voice, I thought. Actually, I wanted an excuse to tell you about a listener in South Africa who wrote, Mrs. Elizabeth Randolph. Her small daughter kept asking her to sing that song about a lion in bed. And it's three little children, a lion in bed. All right. No marks to John, but Frank, your turn. The band was that of Lou Stone. The song was by Michael Carr, but who was the singer?
Dinner for one, please, James. Madam will not be dining. Yes, you may bring the wine in. Love plays such funny games.
Singer?
The singer.
Yes. You'd gone walkabout for a moment, hadn't you?
I was trying to hoist myself back into that era. Yes. He was around at that time.
I can give you a clue. His name occurs in full in the song called The Sergeant Major's on Parade.
Sam Brown.
With Sam Brown, belt and buttons bright, behold the Sergeant Major. Yes, it was Sam Brown singing. Shall we give him a mark or half a mark?
Half.
Everybody says.
Then I'll have the audience's sympathy for the rest of the programme.
Right. Have sympathy instead of marks. That's always a good bargain. Here are some quotations on the subject of music by literary men of various periods. Dr. Johnson once said, "Of all noises, I think music the least disagreeable." He also said, but we'll come to that in a moment. Ian, who wrote, "This will prove a great kingdom for me when I shall have my music for nothing"? I give you a clue. The line is spoken by Stefano, a drunken butler. I'll give you another clue. Where the bee sucks, there suck I.
Taste of honey.
William Shakespeare.
Ah, William Shakespeare, yes. In which play?
Oh, well, if it's the Tempest.
Yes, yes. Do we give him a half mark? I think we do.
Yes.
That's right. "This will prove a great kingdom to me when I shall have my music for nothing." It comes from The Tempest, Act 3. Lines, of course, quoted by people involved in performing rites, obviously. They,
yes. Well, obviously.
Dennis Norton.
I think it's possibly the earliest mention of my music.
Yes. Never thought of that. Dennis, a brilliant but slightly bent poet who ended up in Putney, wrote, "I shall hate sweet music my whole life long." Who was that?
Well, I don't know the quotation, but
slightly bent poet.
Who did he end up with? A chap called Watts Dunton.
Yes, he did. Pines, Putney.
Yes, that would be Algernon Swinburne.
Swinburne it was, yes. He wrote in The Triumph of Time, "I shall hate sweet music my whole life long." Well, I think you get the mark there. And applause, too. I say bent poet, and you come up with the answer, don't you?
Fair enough.
John, a lovely quote for you. "What most people relish is hardly music. It is rather a drowsy reverie, relieved by nervous thrills." The writer of that, I think, prize remark was born in Spain, wrote in English, and taught in America. He died in 1952. He actually taught at Harvard. Do you know who it was? Born Spain, wrote in English, taught at Harvard. Frank,
did his name be Chase?
No.
Was he a philosopher?
Yes, yes.
Not Santayana.
Yes, George Santayana. That's right. So you've got the mark for your time. Frank, your turn. I quoted Johnson a moment ago. Can you recall what the good doctor said of a violinist's performance? Somebody said to him, "That's a very difficult piece that chap is playing."
Yes,
and he said,
"Difficult, you call it. I wish it were impossible."
That's right, yes. Yes. "Difficult, do you call it, sir? I wish it were impossible."
He was marvellous, Johnson. You know, he sort of put up a facade of liking it, but he didn't really like music. Mm. And the gaffe was blown in Boswell's Journal of the Tour to the Hebrides, when he said that he liked very much the bagpipe and would stand with his ear close to the great drone.
the giveaway.
Yes, absolutely.
I'm going to play to you, Ian, a few bars performed on a now obsolete instrument, forerunner of the trombone. The question for you will be, what is the name of the instrument? And then the question to Dennis will be, how did that instrument get its name? It's the lowest instrument you hear in this fanfare in praise of Louis the XII. The shawm plays the top note. The instrument I want you to identify, please, Ian, the instruments are the ones on the bottom. Tough on Dennis. He can't even begin till you've answered. Any idea? The forerunner of the trombone, I said.
It was Oh, that's not the bombard, no.
No, no, it's a boozy sort of sounding thing, rather.
Oh, yes, yes, thank you. Hawk. the sack butt.
The sack butt, that's right. Yes, the sack butt it was, or you heard a couple of them there, I think. So we come to you, Dennis. How did the name sack butt originate, do you think, or perhaps do you imagine is a better?
It's obviously, as every third or fourth schoolboy knows, it's a Viking. It's a Scandinavian word, actually. Two words, sack, butt. Butt is a corruption of boat. And yes. Sack is a diminutive of sacka, which is a Scandinavian word for fool or lackwit or twit. In the, would be the modern yes. parlance, as they say that they're never give a sacka an even break, is it? Because if you do, I don't know if you're familiar with early forms of trombone. If you give them an even break, you can't do anything with them afterwards at all. And so it breaks down into twit boat. Now, why would an early trombone be called a twit boat? Because the Vikings, as you know, came over here in those long boats with the long oars and the horses' heads in front for pillage and rapine. Pillage meant nicking things, and rapine... well, that didn't mean nicking things, but they did. It was much more popular, and there are girls all over the north of England who won't even look at Danish bacon to this day. And obviously, if you came across on this boat with an instrument, you know, because there was no room for personal effects, really, with those long oars, but if you took this early form of trombone with you on your lap, or it left you very little room for manoeuvre with pillage, and practically no room at all for rapine, because they had those very narrow wooden seats that they sat on. So it's a twit boat. In other words, this was an instrument. You were a twit if you took it on the boat. I think if we've cleared that up, we can go on to less important matters.
So you don't know it?
No.
Well, I can tell you, my bit's always boring here. Sack butt comes from the old French sacabout, which was a hook for pulling a man off a horse.
At least mine sounded vaguely plausible.
Plausible, yes, that's right. Well, there you are. The hook like the slide of a trombone, I suppose. Well, now, John, Amos, similarly with you, can you identify the instrument for which Frank will supply the derivation? This comes from an excruciating brass band performance. It's the instrument on the bottom, please, that I want identified. While you're thinking, I'll just name them. That was the Grimthorpe Colliery Institute Band, but they've improved a lot since their record was made under a rather dramatic new influence. Anyway, the instrument on the bottom there, it has been mentioned earlier in the round, actually.
Bombardon,
that's right. The bombardon. They would call it the double B-flat bass bombardon, I think, wouldn't they? Bombardon's the word. Frank's writing it down. And Frank... Dennis, I noticed, talked while he thought. We'd probably get the same from you. How did the name bombardon originate?
Gesture of thanks. Gesture of appreciation, really. Rossini. Rossini was... later on in life, he was no longer a young Rossini. He was a middle-aged Rossini. Wanted to write another opera. And he couldn't get an idea. It could happen to anybody, you know, the wells dry up. And he had an instrument maker. He used to make all the instruments for Rossini's orchestra, who had made this great, enormous sort of tuba thing. And the instrument maker was worried about what to call it. And Rossini was worried about an idea for his new opera. And he said to the instrument maker, I have no idea what subject to take. And the instrument maker said, his mind was on something else, do tell. And he said, you have it. You have given... No, he wasn't there. You have eaten, was he? He was like, you have a give for me, is the idea. He said, I will do what William Tell. And in gratitude for the instrument maker giving him the idea for William Tell, he said, I will compose the opera. And the overture will not only give you the name of your instrument, but it will perpetuate it for all the time. He was a foreign gentleman. Which is why, whenever you hear anybody's humming the overture to the William Tell, you also get an advertisement for the instrument maker's instrument, because it goes... Bum-ba-dum, 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 bum-bum, bum-ba-dum, 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 bum-ba-dum.
Well, there's the answer from Frank. I don't really know how the name bombardon originated, perhaps because the instrument's similar in appearance to a bombard, which was a stone-throwing machine. It's also the name of an organ stop. Let's have a look at the score at the moment, leading at this stage of the game by one mark. Ian Wallace and Dennis Norden. Just a quick round concerning opera choruses. Ian Wallace, where would you find a spinning chorus?
Spinning chorus? I know a spinning quartet. That comes in Martha. Chorus.
Looks like you have practically a mark then. Well, no, I did say a spinning chorus, didn't I?
No, to be quite honest, it is a quartet of soloists who sing it.
No, this is sung by Center.
Oh, the Flying Dutchman.
Yes, half a mark out of one, I think, there. Yes, the opening of Act 2 of the Flying Dutchman. Dennis, where would you find a humming chorus? He's handing his pen to Ian.
I gave my pen to Ian, who sensibly took the top only, leaving me holding the writing bit. A humming chorus you would find in the George Mitchell Choir, the ladies' section, if there was no lock on the door of the dressing room. Butterfly.
That's not
Butterfly. That would be Madam Butterfly. These years in my music without learning something. That's Madam Butterfly.
That's right, yes. The unseen chorus which ends the first scene of Act 2 as Butterfly and the baby await Pinkerton.
Which I once played in Housewife's Choice years ago, and they played it at the wrong speed. And they played it at 45 instead of 33, and nobody noticed. No.
Let's hear a little bit of it at the right speed.
It ought to be a humming chorus by bees.
Pleasant interlude. John, your question is basically too easy. So in your case, let's have where exactly would you expect to hear a pilgrim's chorus? Exactly.
Well, the simple answer is Tannhäuser.
Yes.
You'd expect to hear it, first of all, in the overture, because that's when they first play the tune.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd also expect to find it in the third act.
Yes. Oh, he's smart, this one, you know. He's smart, this one. Yes. He's worth his weight in gold, Frank, isn't he?
Is he
really
not?
Is. Yes.
He's
the first question I got right this evening.
Nevertheless. Frank, your turn. Where would you expect to hear a soldier's chorus?
A soldier's chorus in
say the Naffy, but no.
Faust.
Yes. By?
Well,
pushing it a bit.
By what?
Who knows? Yeah.
Gounod.
Gounod's Faust. Well,
Marlowe,
yes.
I was thinking.
Act 4, Scene 3, and here's a reminder of it.
Learned correspondence about the lyrics one learnt at school of this recently. Learned correspondence, but it was look at your uncle Jim.
Oh, Jemima, look at your uncle Jim.
He's underwater, learning how to swim. First he does the breaststroke, then he does the side. Now he's underwater, swimming against the tide.
Hey. I'm sure the soldiers had a different cause.
Well, just as the first round this week concerned food, so the final round concerns love. Allied subjects, according to psychiatrists. Don't start you off. Dennis, your turn. I'm going to play the second phrase of an amorous plea. See if you can carry on singing.
Ready?
Cinderella. I really can't sing you the words of it. It was a theme. Since I met you, I've had one design. Your wedding shoes placed next to mine. Oh, and
nice.
Though I'm parked on a yellow line.
So divine.
No, I tell you what, Mike. Everybody, all the real musicians on this always got these musical memories of these, you know, great tunes. This was actually the first thing I ever wrote commercially. Was I used to write solos, the organ solos for the people who used to play on the Wurlitzers, Wurlitzer organs. And the first thing I ever did was a lot of topical, of the top popular songs of the time, allied. I changed the words to topical themes, and it was 1938, and the song was Stay in My Arms, Cinderella, and it was when Neville Chamberlain came back, and I did this thing called Stay on My Arm, Umbrella.
And these were written on the slides.
They were written on the slides, and everybody sang along. It was sort of sing-along a den, you know.
John, I'm going to read the dialogue leading up to your song, and then ask you to come in after my little intro. Ready? Giuseppe, we can do without everything else, but we can't do without female society. Marco, and if we have that imperfection, we have everything. There is only one recipe for perfect happiness.
Take a pair of sparkling eyes, here and ever and anon. Do not heed their mild surprise, having passed the Rubicon. Take a pair of rosy lips, take a fig and neatly trimmed, and dum 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 dum. Take me to canary this, take a little tender hand, take a dainty fingeret. Yes, impress it, in parenthesis. Lucky man, if you can, take these all, you lucky man. Lucky man, if you can.
Frank, follow that. Your turn,
hey.
Frank. No, don't. Please don't. Frank, some love letters tied in blue ribbon, a couple of photographs. Where are such things to be found?
Bear some lipstick. No, that's
not. No.
Give me a clue. Give me a melodic. Oh. A photograph or two. A ribbon coloured blue, a plate of Irish stew, a marmite souvenir.
That would do, I think.
Just use chimney
sweep. Like the Irish stew. I like the Irish stew, that's lovely. Ian, in your case, I'm going to play the second eight bars of the love song and ask you to come in from the middle bit onwards.
Here we go.
was so busy limbering up.
Yes.
missed the entrance.
Fell over the starting block.
I won't ask you to play all that again,
right.
Steve.
Longing to tell you, but afraid and shy, I'd let my golden chances pass me by. Soon you'd leave me, a few would go in the mist of day. Never, never to know. I love you. If I loved you.
Sounding top E flat. Thank you, Ian. And with that, we leave you. The score, a half mark in it. A victory by half a mark for Ian Wallace and Dennis North. Goodbye.
Taking part in My Music were John Amis, Frank Muir, Dennis Norden, and Ian Wallace. The questions were compiled by our chairman, Steve Race, and the program was produced for the BBC by Tony Schreier.